Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty. Today we've kept the hotel empty to welcome in life coach, author of Blind Vision, and all-around motivated motivator, Mr. Chad Myers. Chad, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, man, we're grateful to have you. So I know you got a lot of cool things going on with Sea Captain Coaching right now, and you're helping a lot of people, but I kind of want to press rewind and get us to this point. When in your life does it strike you that you either get motivated by someone around you or you start to feel this intrinsic motivation and you know you've got something to share?
It's kind of like I just have this passion, this desire. I think I've always been this way. I think because of my dad, my backstory, even as a school teacher, I wanted to inspire, I wanted to educate, I wanted to motivate, and I was doing things that were really different, like as opposed to in the morning, I would just put an inspirational quote up or something and get people to talk about it and think about it and journal it. So
when you were teaching?
Yeah. So this has always been a part of me. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, as we talked about the book, that my backstory has a lot to do with why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Okay. So where does the backstory start in your eyes?
Well, that's a great question.
No pun intended.
That's a great question because that's one of the first things I ask people is, what is your story? What's the story you're telling yourself? What is your story from your past? Because we're all somehow creating our own stories, and sometimes we don't get a choice, especially the first 7 years of our life. So my story starts with my father, his life, and when he was sent to Nam when he was 19, he was there for a very short amount of time, but he went on a 70-day search and destroy mission in Nam.
Good Lord.
And he was in one of the most dangerous territories in the history of warfare. He didn't realize it at the time, but all the research that we did, he was in a very dangerous area, landmines everywhere, tunnels everywhere. And he was new to the country, but he was told in ambush school, don't park in shaded areas if you're going to take a break or pull off the side of the road, because very often that's where the enemy plants the landmines.
Mm.
My dad remembered this. The driver of the vehicle, he was actually headed towards the shaded area. My dad was just trying to warn him, but it was too late.
Oh.
They ran over a landmine, and everybody in the vehicle was injured. I'm not sure what happened to the other guys, but I'm pretty sure my dad probably took some of the worst of it. What happened is there was shrapnel wounds, but the explosion from the landmine shattered his eyes. So he was rushed to a field hospital and going in and out of consciousness. And somewhere, sometime in this, I don't know how many days, he said he woke up and with bandages on his eyes. And he was yelling and screaming, where am I? What happened? What's going on? Someone talk to me. Someone communicate with me. He was feeling all over his face. He could feel his body. He's like, oh, my God. He was like, somebody tell me what's going on.
Right.
So he said the communication wasn't all that great. But they sent him back home and contacted my mom, our whole entire family, his parents, and said, you know, we're sending him home. We went to Valley Forge. From there, I believe he came back home for a short period of time, but then they took him to Heinz VA Hospital in Chicago. This is a rehabilitation for people who have lost their sight. And when he was there, and this is a theme in my book, my dad is very, very fortunate. And I believe that when you decide, hey, I'm going to do something about my life, I'm not going to be a victim,
mm-hmm.
Providence shows up, people show up. The universe shows up, however you want to say it, but something shows up. And so as I was writing my book, I began to study The Hero's Journey by Joseph Campbell.
Ah.
And so he is the world's leading expert on myths, and in every culture, there's a hero's journey's myth. And I believe that if we really look at this, we're all on some kind of a hero's journey, and we're all on our own, but sometimes we don't even realize it. And when you start to become aware, oh, I'm being called into another chapter.
Right.
I mean, I know this is an example everybody would understand. Star Wars is a great example of the hero's journey. Luke Skywalker went on it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was called away from his home and was sent somewhere else and met mentors on the way. So my dad's first mentor was a blind World War II veteran.
Ah.
So here he shows up on the scene, and he said, my dad always talked about this guy. His name is Milt Joe.
What a name.
Yeah. He said, Mill Joe was like so charismatic. He was so fun. He was so full of life. He said he lived life with gusto. You'd never know the guy was blind. And he said, he taught me some things. And one of the things I learned is, he said, if you can learn to accept your blindness, accept it. Don't be a victim. Over time, you can become the best version of yourself as a blind man. So it's a process, it's a journey. So my dad grew up on a farm, or worked on farms, and played sports, very athletic, had a really good work ethic, which is a lost art these days, but had a really strong work ethic, especially working on the farms and then, you know, playing sports.
And in the Midwest at that point?
Yeah, or in Michigan, yeah.
Okay, so.
Yep. So so you can imagine losing his eyesight was really hard for him.
Right.
Because he was so active. And he would share things like, when I lost my eyesight and was sent to the Heinz VA hospital, I was afraid to go to the bathroom. I was afraid to go anywhere. I was afraid to do anything. I was afraid to leave my bed. He said, by the time they got done with me, I was crossing five lanes in downtown Chicago with a cane.
That's wild.
Yeah. So what he learned is neuroplasticity. He learned, he retrained his brain. So he began to get maps in his brain, and he could actually, through spaced repetition, he was able to navigate with his cane, and through the repetition, he could map things out. So my dad's brain was incredible. His frontal lobe developed very quickly after this accident. And in the book, we have a neuroscientist who he wrote a whole chapter about my dad from a brain's point of view, what he did and how he's able to do it. I'm not going to get too heavy into the brain today. So my dad was able to retrain his brain, and he went back home. And one of the things that I specifically remember him saying, I wrote it in the book, is he's like, I'm not sitting around collecting a disability check. I'm not sitting around, period. He said, I felt like a caged lion. He said, I just remember, he said, you know what? When I was in the military, I was in the best shape of my life. I was, one of the leaders in all the drills, and I loved competition, so I went to the gym. He said, I got in great shape. And so my dad's, you know, blind guy at the gym, and the guys in the gym said, look, you're an inspiration. Like, you're in better shape than most of the other guys in here, and you can't even see. And he says, guys, I want a job. I don't know where to find a job. And sometimes they even, like, he would just get dropped off in a downtown area with his cane and go around looking for a job. He wanted the job. It's crazy, but he wanted the job. So they said, we're going to call the newspaper. And there's a picture in the book, and there's a picture when I do seminars and I do workshops and I do stuff. Mm-hmm. I have this picture. It's a picture of my dad feeding me. I'm one, and he's maybe 23, 24 years old. And it says, blinded vet wants job. And so this was in Michigan. And so in Fenton, Michigan, there's a gentleman in the book. His name is Denny Floden. He read the article that night, and he's like, what an incredible story.
Right.
And he says he said he was emotional. It moved him. I know this because I actually interviewed him for a couple of years to make sure I understood everything. But he said he was moved. And so he called my dad, and he says, I just read the article, and I'm, you know, from Mass Mutual, and I'd like to come and talk to you about maybe giving you a job. And he's like, I'd never heard of you. He said, well, we've never heard of you either. But that article is something else. So I think we should talk. So he came and spoke with my dad. And again, he said he was really moved. He went back to the office, and he says, I think I made a big mistake. He talked to his manager or his boss, he's, what do you mean? He goes, I think I just offered a blind guy a job. I think I gave him false hope.
Ouch.
He said, I don't know what to do. And he said, I hope he doesn't call. So my dad said, you know what? What the hell do I got to lose?
Right.
So he said, I want to try this. So the guy said, look, he gave him a stack of books. You know, these are pre-licensed, pre-assessment. You got to go take all this stuff first. And once you do all this, then you can take the state test. But first, you got to pass this. And he said, I think I, I think I got rid of the blind guy. Well, little did he know that my dad went and got all these books from the Federation of Blind and got all on tape.
And listened. There's to always
it.
A way.
There's always a way. Never made excuses. So he's like, so he listened to it over and over and over and over again. And so he called the guy because I'm ready to take the test. He's like, what are you talking about? He said, well, I'm ready to take the test. And so he came in and he said he was answering the question before I can get him finished. And so he passed all the tests there at the office and, you know, all their pre-licensed stuff. And then he went to his boss, what am I going to do? I got a blind veteran here who wants the damn job. He said, well, what would you do if he could see?
Yeah, and he's bothered to learn all the information, so now you really got it.
He said, well, I would call the state of Michigan to set up the test. So he did. And he goes, oh, one more thing, ma'am. Our guy is going to need a proctor, someone to read the test to him. She goes, what are you talking about? We can't see.
They're like, come again?
They says, we don't do that. There's only one person allowed. The only person in the room is the proctor and the people taking the test. That's the rules. And this is when the story really, when I was interviewing my dad, this guy, my dad's mentor, Denny, he got teared up when he was sharing this with me. I was like, wow. He says, ma'am, let me help you. I want to save you. He says, you go talk to your boss. You ask your boss if it's okay for me to contact their TV station, the radio stations, the newspapers in Flint, Lansing, and Detroit, telling them that the state of Michigan is denying a test to a blind Vietnam veteran.
Yeah, right.
He said, if your boss is okay with that, let me know. She called me back in about an hour. And he actually told this story. We told this story in front of a big audience, in front of actually the State of Michigan Mental Health Conference. We were the keynote speakers. And that's a whole other story from their time. But he said this in front of like 1,000 mental health professionals all over at this big conference. Mm-hmm. And he, again, got teared up. The lady granted the test. My dad got a 93. And,
nice.
From there on... my dad said, I don't want you to treat me like a disabled blind guy. I want you to treat me just like you would everybody else. So if you said to this guy over here who's sighted, this is what you should do, that's what I'm going to do. He says, okay, careful what you ask for. He said, this guy kicked his ass, his mentor. His mentor just was tough on him, but in a loving way, and he believed in him. And I said to him, I'm like, you know, why? And so in the book later, I was what really made you hire my dad? And all of a sudden, again, this is an old man who probably wasn't very in tune with his emotions, but he became vulnerable.
Right.
And he said, I've never told anybody this before, but I was a foster care kid. I was taken away from my mother, and I don't even know who my father was. And I was a ward of the state of Indiana, and I went from foster care home to foster care home. And then one day, I had a mentor or a coach show up in my life, and there's the theme again, another mentor. So my dad's had two mentors. This guy goes back and says, I was at the YMCA, and there was a gentleman by the name of Coach Fetters. He says, he's the closest thing I ever had for a dad. And he had a little tear come down his cheek, and I said, oh, my goodness. He says, Coach Fetters was a great coach, and he taught me about life. He taught me about winning. He said, under the tutelage of Coach Fetters, I won 5 state championships as a swimmer for the state of Indiana, and I got a full-ride scholarship to the University of Michigan.
Dang.
I was like, what? He goes, yeah, I was a 3-time All-American, and we won 3 national championships. If it wasn't for Coach Fetters, I wouldn't be here. He says, I went back to Coach after all my success, and I got hired, and I told Coach I was going to pay him back. He says, young man, he says, with his wise smile, this old man says, pay it forward. I said, son of a gun, you hired my... I said, is this a conscious thing? He goes, I don't know. I said, you just paid it forward when you hired my dad. He went through all the training. My dad was great at relationships and people. He'd listen. So he would say things. And so his first contract year, They have, you know, like all these different types of awards that you can win, you know. But Mass Mutual had never hired a blind guy.
He's the first blind
in Mass Mutual, Northwestern Mutual, New York Life. I mean, these are all the top companies out there, and
right.
They had never hired one before, and so they have this. It's called the Freshman Five, and he said to Denny, "Has anybody in this office ever won the Freshman Five?" He goes, "No, it's pretty rare. Like, no, like it's you got to be top five in the nation,
right? Yeah. And there's way bigger markets than this.
Yeah, so this doesn't happen." So I'd ask, "Well, you guys ever hired a blind guy?" "No, nobody's ever won this award." He goes, "I'm going to be the first." So he began to so this is why the book's called Blind Vision. My dad began to visualize everything that he wasn't supposed to do. He began to visualize, "Well, I'm going to be one of the top salesmen. I'm going to actually live life with gusto like Milt Joe told me to." He said Milt came to visit me before Milt passed away. He said one of the last times he came to visit me, he said, "Well, what'd you love to do when you were in school? Before you lost your eyesight?" He goes, "Milt, I water skied all the time."
Yeah.
"Love water skiing. We grew my, you know, it was a lake right by where I lived."
Right.
He said, "We'll get back on them." So my dad began to see himself skiing again in his mind. And he began to visualize, "Okay, you know what? I just have to trust the boat just like I used to. I just don't have eyeballs." And so I was sitting in the back of the boat watching my dad slalom water ski, not just water ski, but slalom water ski across the lake like a sighted man. I didn't understand it at the time, like that's not normal. But then, so those are the kind of things mentors encourage. Like, so it's kind of like a coach, a mentor, somebody that's like, "Look, you got potential. I believe in you. You can do more than you think," right? Kind of like what, going back to the Star Wars, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you know, Yoda, let's go to the next level, right? You can do this. So that's what ended up happening is at the end of my dad's rookie year, he was freshman five winner.
Love it.
And trip to Puerto Rico, and just all of a sudden his life completely shifted from this disabled, depressed, unemployed blind guy to one of the top rookie guys in the nation with one of the largest insurance companies in the United States. And then I'm hearing all these, then I'm looking through the like scrapbooks. I'm like, what is this? Oh, I spoke at Ford Theater in Detroit. I think there might have been 3,000 people there. I was like, what? Yeah, that was the year I won the Oscar salesmanship. Paul Harvey was there. I don't know if you remember Paul Harvey and the rest of the story. He said, "You know what? He wasn't very nice to me. He was kind of a prick, but my dad, you know, that's him."
And yeah, call him how you see him.
Yeah, and he's sitting in the front row. They called him up, and he went up and delivered a talk. He says, "In just 2 or 3 years, I went from, I didn't even know if I wanted to live, to now I'm on stage speaking in front of 3,000 people. How did this happen?" And I was like, that's a damn book.
Right.
When he's telling me these stories, I'm like, this is a book. And so that's the home I grew up in, and not only with the water skiing, but like I wrote in the book, like the guy was doing judo. Like you imagine judo, where you get your hands on somebody. It doesn't matter if you can see or not. If you get your hands on, you can get you in some holds and some moves. And
I know that one
so,
personally.
Like, and my dad again. Like I just remember, I have a picture in here of like I looked at my dad, and I'm like, hey, looks like Lou Ferrigno. Like he just was huge, just a big guy, always lifting weights and like I said, judo. My dad played blind golf. I don't even know how that's even possible. Obviously, with the gutters, we didn't have the gutter things that they have now where you can prevent the gutters.
Oh, yeah.
So he would try to bowl. Sometimes he'd throw it down the wrong alley. No, we're on two. You're just doing it on three.
That's right. At least you got a legit excuse.
Right.
Geez, even with my limited vision, I've never thought of – I mean, I've attempted to golf, but it's difficult even with how limited my vision is. And when everybody's athleticism outpaced mine as I got older, I had to give up playing basketball and baseball and the things that I really loved and start wrestling because I couldn't do nothing, but I could take out my contacts and essentially see nothing. But as soon as I had my hands on you, we can wrestle.
There you go.
So that's so funny that, I mean, I think, I guess it's just one of those innate things if you allow it to be. But I guess that's kind of my operative question for you is, what do you think is the difference between people that allow themselves to say, for want of a better way of putting it, fuck it, I'm still going to do this, versus the people that say, for whatever reason, they have a narrative that plateaus themselves?
It's a great question. It's a difference. It's a choice. People don't realize you actually get a choice because life's not fair. Like, he could have said, you know what, my life's over.
Easily.
He could have. That's a choice. But he chose to have what I call a growth mindset, grit, resilience, perseverance. Like, I mean, he was just ruthless. Like, just, I'm not giving up. I'm going to keep going. It is what it is. This is my life. This is the cards I was dealt. Okay, let's go.
Do you think there were things fundamentally about your father or people like that, that those situations they go through bring out, or that those situations cause those mentalities?
That's another great question. And I mean, I'm going to get deep in the weeds.
That's okay.
Some of this is, I was a school teacher before I became a coach. I was actually, before I left, I called myself the coach in the classroom because I completely changed my philosophy on education and how I taught. But I'm sorry, repeat your question again. I went off track.
I'm just wondering if you feel like people that have these differences between pushing themselves, is this something that's just fundamentally part of people, or these are things that circumstantially come about?
Thank you for sticking with us. We hope you're enjoying the episode. We'd like to take this opportunity to give a shout out to our number one supporter, Tweed Suit Shop.
Hey guys, I'm Donald with Tweeds. If you're ever in the market for a custom suit, tuxedo, sport coat, whatever it might be, we'd love the opportunity for you to come in, we'll take all your measurements, we'll make sure we get you the perfect fit and the perfect look. We'd love to see you at one of our locations.
So remember, if you want to get yourself fresh like this, tit to tail, see Tweeds at one of their locations in Sarasota, St. Pete, or Tampa. Please enjoy the rest of the episode.
Yeah. Going back to the mentors and coaches that showed up, but also my dad talks a lot about his upbringing and his work ethic. And I think that today, the reason why I brought up the whole teaching thing is because I saw students begin to change over the years where I saw a shift. And a lot of it had to do with parents and a lot of enabling. Oh, no, Johnny can't do his homework because he has ADHD. So things like that. Well, it's kind of like, well, blind guy can't take a test because he can't see.
Yeah, I know that line.
I mean, like, you can make up anything you want, right? But so I think a lot of it had to do with my dad's parents expected him to, like he had jobs growing up. And so he, again, that work value, I think values aren't really taught anymore.
Ah.
And character and, you know, integrity, things like that. So I think my dad's upbringing helped a lot. But also, too, I think that a lack of awareness, people aren't aware that, oh, you mean I get a choice? Yeah, you can be a victim or you can be the hero. You're in the story. If you don't like the script, rip it up. You get a free, like, I'm a writer, I'm like, well, what would you like? What do you want?
That seems too easy, though.
It seems easy. It's not, the process isn't easy.
Right.
Because you have to be willing to change, and people don't like change. Well, people don't resist change. They resist being changed. So if I tell you, Eric, you really need to change, you're going to go like, you know what? Screw you. I'm not changing for you, right? We don't really change for other people, but if I inspire you by a story, for example, like this one, you're like, wait, I think I would like to make some changes. And then you partner with somebody and then you like come up with a plan. And so what happens is people, they don't, number one, dream. They don't think outside the box. They're not willing to get out of their comfort zone.
Why do you think that is?
It's hard to change. I think old behavior patterns, I think it's so easy to fall back into them. And I think what happens is when people start off on a goal or a journey and they're like, all right, that's it. I'm going to exercise every day and I'm never going to eat sweets again.
Yeah, right.
And then that lasts for like 3 days.
Yeah.
That's not how it's done. That's why, like, again, I've had great mentors and coaches, and I have a coach. I have a therapist and a coach. And without, I mean, it just helps to have, forgive the pun, but you can't see your own blind spots.
Right.
Like, that's why somebody's there to kind of help you and guide you. And
that's the irony of being unaware. You're unaware. Right.
So I think it's just a lack of awareness of like, oh, so I can change. Yeah, it's going to be uncomfortable. You got to get out of your comfort zone. It's going to suck. But at the same time, when you look back, like however long this takes, 6 months, 12 months, whatever, I went on a 2-year transformational journey. I kickstarted it, but I went on a 2-year transformation, and I call it my mind, body, soul transformation. That's like, and I actually, because of blind vision, I'm like, you know, I'm kind of stuck in this story. I wrote my, like, what's my story?
Mm.
And so I'm kind of now in this thing, I'm calling it beyond vision. Go beyond the vision. What does that mean? So I got this idea, like a lot of times we like plateau. We're like, oh, I've arrived.
And exactly.
It looks, what a beautiful view. And you're looking at, you know, over the plateau at the beautiful scenery. And then you're like, oh, wait, I'm supposed to summit.
Right.
And we get comfortable. And what got us to the plateau or what got us to base camp, it's not going to get us to the summit. You need a Sherpa and a guide. You know, tell me one person that climbed Mount Everest without a Sherpa and a guide. It's not possible. So I think a lot of times in leadership, because, like, I mean, I've been educating now and doing consulting, training, educating for over 35 years. It's like, it didn't happen overnight. It's little by little, we go through these changes, these processes, but I realized that I was recently in a plateau, and I'm like, I've got to go beyond vision. I can't see the summit. I know it's there. I need to go. How am I going to, that's, what's my next chapter? And so I just recently had an event here at the Sarasota Modern, just to kind of introduce Sea Captain Coaching, introduce what I do.
Right. And yeah. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. I just wanted to plug into the community and just say, hey, Sea Captain Coaching, we're here. We are virtual, but at the same time, this is where my headquarters are. My business partner, Phil, is in Lakewood Ranch part-time and Newport, Rhode Island, therefore the name Sea Captain Coaching. Because he could see the ships, the sailboats and stuff in the harbor, and he began to write like a captain's log when he was actually a managing partner for Fortune 100 CEO. Fortune 100 company, and he was managing partner for a big firm. So when he resigned, that's when he created Sea Captain Coaching. And so now, I said to him, I'm like, I'd like to create an event called Beyond Vision and team up with you to just let everybody know we're here and what we do. And out of that came this whole mind, body, soul transformation idea. And I'm big on balance, wellness, well-being, happiness, happiness in the workplace, happiness in life, period. Maybe joy might be a better word than happiness. But there are just certain things that we can do to help us be happier and healthier. And a lot of it has to do with a lot of the research I've done. But at this event, we shared this out. My dad flew in. And,
awesome.
He's sitting in the audience because he always asks me, he goes, well, what am I supposed to say? I said, you don't have to say anything. I'm going to talk about you and your story. And then we went into what is a growth mindset? What does it mean to grow? How do you grow? Einstein said, the measure of intelligence is a person's ability to change.
Mm.
I thought, oh, well, if we have to adapt, we have to change.
Because it's not survival of the fittest. It's actually survival of the most adaptable.
Right. What companies thrived during COVID, the ones that adapted, they like, we got to change. We got to figure this out. And there's certain companies, and I study the cultures, and like, what did they do? And it really created these teams of people that were able to work together and bond together and bring out the best in each other. So I started studying, like, what makes the best teams. Mm. And how do you create leaders amongst your team so that kind of everybody's in the right position, like almost like a baseball team? Mm-hmm. You put your best players in the best positions, kind of a thing. And so I started to see themes and patterns. So when I first got into this corporate coaching or this executive coaching space, I would listen on Zoom to my business partner, Phil, on these calls. And he's doing calls all over the United States and might have 5, 10 you know, or more people on groups. Mm-hmm. And I began to watch this over and over and over again for like 18 months. I was taking notes. And I started seeing themes because, again, the author in me, I was like writing themes down. And I was like, retention's a problem. Culture's a problem. Happiness in the work, belonging is a problem. If you don't belong, you don't feel like you belong, and you don't feel like you're making a difference, people leave.
Especially younger people.
That's right. And Indeed's a transfer portal now.
Yep.
And so I think it's really important to find out how do you create an environment where people want to be there. And I use a lot of my – it's amazing. I never realized how much my experience as a teacher would help me as a coach. But I'm like, I'm just working with big people now.
Yep.
You know, people are people.
That's right.
And but I started to see it in my classroom. I'm like, what kind of a culture do I want? What kind of classroom do I want? How do I want the kids to feel? What kind of leader do I want to be? Do I really want to be a teacher? What kind of a teacher? I mean, what does that even mean? Like, so I began to ask myself all these questions. And one of the things I did is I realized, well, the reason why a lot of kids have ADHD is if you look around a classroom, there's nothing but bulletin boards and, you know, like, multiplication table charts or, you know, the writing process, all the stuff's just all over the place. And if you look in a lot of the rooms, and I'm not judging anybody, but I thought it's distracting. So I thought, why don't I feng shui my classroom?
Right.
And put like earth tones in here and have some relaxing music and put some bamboo in here and just like make it fun and flow. And that's exactly what I did. And then I began to like play music in the morning before school, and all these other kids were wild. Like, what's going on in here? It's Mr. Meyer's classroom. This looks different. Yeah, it is different. Well, how do you get in this class? So I mean, literally, I mean, I taught in you know, my beginnings of my my teaching career was in Flint, Michigan. And I remember there were kids knocking on my door, wanting in my classroom because, well, I cared about the kids. I had fun with them. And one of the things I did is I leveraged things. So I would say if I saw a bunch of kids that aren't getting their work done, I'm like, hey, we're all going to go outside when you guys finish. I'm taking you. It's snowing out. I goes, I know. We're going to make a snowman, snow forts. What? Yeah. Get your work done. So they would work. We'd go outside, build snow forts, you know, stuff like that. And like, I mean, I literally would let, what can I let, how can I get the most out of them? And I began to empower some of the kids. And
there's the operative word.
Yep, I empowered them. And so, like, I don't care what your circumstances are, your background. You can come from poverty. You can come, like, you can lose your eyes. You can, like, go through a divorce. You can have a heart attack. Like, something wakes us up. Life wakes us up somehow. Like if the universe will get our attention, if we're not willing to change, my dad says, you don't have to get your eyes blown out to change.
Right. Amen to that.
He said, by God, I must have been stubborn because God really had to get my attention. And so my dad is a much better person. He said, I'm a better human being after I lost my eyes. Emotionally, spiritually, physically, like I tapped into something different. I probably would not have been as successful as a sighted guy. He goes, I think I might have had an unfair advantage. I'm like, what?
That's a sentiment I can relate to. That's funny that you say that. Peculiar funny that you say that. So that, you know, your dad can quantify he feels better in all these ways after the fact because it's his personal experience, and you can quantify it because you see the before and after. And this is kind of where I'm interested in how you gauge what you're doing. It's easy to quantify when someone is more healthy, they're more fit, they're they have biometrics we can all say come to. How do you quantify when you feel that someone's doing better emotionally, doing better in their own skin? What's some of that stuff when you start to realize that someone is starting to make better choices?
I like that's a great question. I would call it emotional regulation. A lot of times we can co-regulate each other, but if someone can't regulate their emotions, control themselves on their own, and they're constantly relying on somebody else, that's not healthy. We need to learn to do it on our own. So I would say things like, oh, I'm getting upset. I need to go breathe. I need to go step away and just calm myself down. I'm getting a little upset. I'm going to go for a walk. You know what? I think I need to go to yoga tonight. I should probably go for a walk or a run. Maybe I ought to hit the gym instead of ruminate.
Right.
I'm sitting around. I'm thinking, maybe I should go do some community service. Maybe I should get out. What happens a lot of times, we spiral down, and you spiral up by taking agency. You do something, and instead of sitting around waiting for something to happen, you say, well, I'm going to do something. So I think it's taking agency for your life and doing things. I would call them self-enhancing instead of self-defeating habits.
Yeah, so that's exactly what I was going to say. What do you think is what do you think is one of the big hurdles that gets people from being stuck in one of these spots where they're negatively compounds and you're in this downward spiral, and that's the only way things seem, to getting them to realize that upward spiral is equally possible and equally true? It's only a matter of these mindset shifts.
Okay, so first of all, I think reaching out, can't go about it alone. There's a thing in the military they call the POW, is called the TAP code. And the leaders realize we have to communicate with everybody here to keep each other alive. Hmm. So they created this TAP code and they communicated. And the theme behind that is we all need somebody. We need, and it only takes one person. It only takes one person to believe in you to make a difference. Could be a teacher, could be an uncle, could be a coworker, somebody. It only takes one. And then you say, here, borrow my belief for a little while until you believe in yourself.
Ah.
So number one, reach out for help. You can't go about it alone. And I also think it's really important to surround yourself with people who you want to be like. Hmm. Where the average, like Jim Rohn has a quote, I don't know how accurate it is, but actually there is a lot of research behind this. You're the average of the five people you spend the most time with. There's a book called Connected. So if you are hanging out with somebody, like let's say that your five closest friends are all depressed, the likelihood of you being depressed is pretty high.
At least five times more likely.
Yeah. And so there is a lot of research out there on mirror neurons. So it's kind of like the monkey see, monkey do. If I'm around somebody's energy and it's negative, it's angry, it's depressed, then I need for myself to step outside of that and, like, again, go for a walk, do something to get away from it. And I think it's being around the right people. I really do. I think that's so key. So that's how I would answer that.
So a lot of it has to do with choices and habits, very clearly. But how does one start, or in your view, how does one start to build the habits of making these better choices?
I just read that in the book this morning. My dad mentioned this. He's like, I really didn't know what to do, but I knew if I just take the right next step.
Yeah.
So for him, it was like, you know what? I think I need to go to the gym. I need to get out of the house. I'm bored.
Mm.
I have no purpose. I got to get in shape. That was his next step. Then the next step after that was, I need to connect. There's people in the gym. Hey, how you doing? Hey, my name's Howard, blah, blah, blah. Just meeting people in the gym. And so now he had a social network. So you have an exercise routine. You're building a social network. And then the next step was, you know what? I need purpose and meaning. I want to go get a job. I want to make a difference. I need to be a part of society. And he said, I wanted to prove that I was still a man. after losing my eyes.
Well, what do you see as the biggest hurdle for people, literally or figuratively, getting off the couch to let that domino effect start to happen? It's the empowering themselves or giving themselves permission or negating the fear somehow. What is this point between when I'm sitting on the couch and I can get myself mentally aware to get off the couch and then actually do it? What do you think the cotter pin is there?
That's a great question. I remember I had a coach. He would say, well, what are you doing about your depression? And I just remember listening to a bunch of excuses.
Mm.
And he says, what are you doing about your depression? I was like, I listen those more things, more yeah. excuses. What are you doing about your depression? I'm like, oh, my God. It's on me. Like, wait, I'm not getting out of this.
You got to run the excuse gamut.
Yeah, and then he said, didn't you say you were going to go to the gym last week when we talked that you want to go start going to the gym on a regular basis because you told me that the gym really helps with your depression. I was like, yeah. How many days did you go to the gym? I didn't go to the gym. What? I didn't go to the gym. I don't even know why, because most of my life I've been pretty disciplined about that. But again, we all go through times in our lives where we're not our best selves.
Of course.
And I was depressed. I was going through, actually, I was going through a breakup. I was sad. Which is normal.
Right.
And he's like, here's another thing. Don't numb your pain. Don't numb it. Feel it. And I began to feel it.
That's a powerful thing.
I was like, there's no way out of this. I was like, oh my God. So when I get into research that feelings and emotions are just messengers, it's not who I am. I'm not my thoughts. Those are thoughts.
Yeah.
I'm not my thoughts.
No.
I'm not even my emotions. They're just visitors.
Right.
So when I learned this, I actually went to a bench on the beach, Sunset Beach, and it was a bench that I used to sit a lot, and I sat down one day and I said, grief, have a seat. And I put my arm around grief. I said, what are you trying to teach me? I just remember, oh my God, what a question.
Seriously.
I mean, I went deep, and I just, like, a lot of tears, just stuff that I was holding inside, I didn't even know it.
Mm.
But I just, like, released a lot of stuff, and I'm like, you know what? It's okay. It's okay. You visited with grief, now let it go. So I began to learn that little by little, you visit, you don't ruminate, you don't stay there, you don't spend a lot of time, but you visit. Another thing too is I would really encourage people to write. It was cathartic for me. I wrote, I put myself in a story, and instead of saying I said Chad.
Mm.
And I began to look at the story from like omniscient point, like what is it, third person, I guess?
Yeah.
And put myself in the story, and I'm like, what do I want? And I begin to write out what I want instead of what I didn't want.
Yes.
And I began to make that shift. So, yeah, I think the biggest problem, especially guys, like we're taught, well, you just shove it down, toughen up.
Walk it off.
Go have a beer.
Yeah.
Like, or how about get distracted with, and I love sports, but like, boy, sometimes if you can, like in the fall, you can watch sports from like Friday night all the way till Monday night football, right? And you didn't even think.
Right.
No reflection. Nope. Like, you're just, it's almost like we're numbing ourselves. We're distracting ourselves. I'm all for entertainment.
We're taking black paint to the third eye.
Right. So I think as men, we need to learn to deal with our emotions and feelings. And it's okay to talk about them. It's okay to feel them. It's okay to, I'm not saying be feminine.
Right.
I'm just saying deal with your feelings. And by the way, a lot of the females I talked to said, when you do your retreats, if you do have like a men's only retreat, would you please help them communicate better, speak on communication, effective communication, emotional intelligence, empathy, compassion, be more understanding. How about if you listen? And this is something we all, like, I'm still working on this myself. We all are.
Well, empathy is one of these really hot button or words right now. It's like ego death and being empathetic. These are the two things that you got to do if you're going to be a good person. What do you think is the reason why we became either so unempathetic or we just realized all of a sudden one another we didn't have much empathy for one another? What happened there? What's the operative thing there?
It wasn't really taught. I actually did a lot of research on this. Brené Brown said that she went back in some of the old military records I'm not sure which branch, but she went back into some of the military records and some of the stuff that they were writing back then, like in the 1940s maybe. And they had a lot of, they were teaching compassion, emotional intelligence, but then they took it out. So it was taught. Then it was just like, well, bottom line is, let's just, you know, make cars, make revenue, build soldiers. We're machines.
Capitalism takeover.
Yeah. We are not human beings. Well, we are, but like,
yeah,
it was just kind of like not really spoken about, wasn't really talked about. And in homes where it's compassion and values and morals are taught, and when there's stability, you know, then that child has a great chance to be a contributing member of society and make a difference. And there are a lot of families that still do that. But to me, I think it's not taught. It's not taught in corporations. I don't even know if people know what it is. And I'll never forget the day when I really started to understand what empathy was. I was in a class and I was teaching still, but I was coaching and teaching. I was like moonlighting, and I don't care if my old school knows this or not, but there's a student that kind of had their head down. They weren't working. The first thought I normally would have got is like, this student must be lazy. Maybe they stayed up all night. What's their problem? Get your work done.
And right.
I didn't say it, but that was my first thought. And I said, no, that's not compassion. That's not empathy. I got down on my knee. I said, I notice you're not working today. Is everything okay? Student picked up their head, looked at me. My dog got hit by a car this morning, Mr. Myers. I was like, oh, man, I'm so sorry. Yeah, he didn't make it. Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, no wonder why you're not working. I get it. And then I said, you know, I lost my dog too, you know, when I was growing up, blah, blah, blah. I said, hey, listen, I'm going to come back and check on you in about 10 minutes. Just make sure everything's okay. I'll circle back around. I come back 10 minutes later, student's working. What do they want? They want to be heard. I belong. Somebody listened to me. Somebody understood me. If I would have said, get your work done, or you're going to the office.
Right.
It doesn't work.
No.
But how? Think about it. That's to me is the difference. That's getting out of judgment and going into empathy.
Right. So we are in very much a world right now that almost incentivizes judgment. How do you think we can get to the point, and this is largely the theme of Keep the Hotel Empty, what do you think are some of the things we can do for ourselves and one another to start to be, even if we can't make it to empathy, we can start to be more acceptable and inclusive than judgmental and exclusive?
Great question, and I think I'm going to say start with yourself. Think about the inner dialogue, the inner conversations we have with ourselves. When we mess up, is it self-love? What's that conversation? A lot of people have a really negative inner, I call it there's an inner coach or an inner critic. And I think a lot of times we're judging ourselves, we're self-judgmental. Let's say that we've done some things that is self-defeating habits, and then we're like, you're an idiot, you never do what you say you're gonna do, you're a loser, see, you should never set goals, you know, who do you think you are, you're an idiot, blah, 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 right?
Every time it's the same.
Set head trash. Would you say that to a friend? Would you speak that way to a friend? No, probably not. What would you say? Hey, get back up. You got this. It's okay. You messed up. That's all right. I'm here for you if you need me. What do you need? I'm here to support you. You got to do it, but if you need to talk, I'm here. That's what you would tell a friend. So that's the conversation we should be having with ourselves. Like, I stopped beating myself up. Doesn't work. I started saying, what would you tell a client? Be an inner coach. Coach yourself. So self-love, self-compassion, self-care. start with myself. When I become self, I think self-discipline is self-love in many ways, because I care about myself. I want to make sure I'm happy, I'm healthy. I want to be a better version of myself, so that when I, maybe a better example to my son as a father, or to my clients, or to my friends, I want to be an example. And so, it's working on yourself first, and then your results and other people will follow. So it's kind of like you first. And then when you accept yourself just as you are, like, let's say you look, like I looked in the mirror one day and I was like, my God, like, who are you? I had gained a lot of weight, because I normally don't carry extra weight on myself. And I had, again, through a difficult time in my life, depressed, overweight. But I didn't, it shifted when I said, I'm going to do something for me. I'm going to love myself, and I'm going to get rid of these self-defeating habits, and I'm going to develop self-enhancing habits, and I'm going to have compassion for myself. I'm not going to judge myself. What is that going to do? I'm going to beat myself up, get myself a black eye.
Well, for some people, it's to circle back, it's the excuse. It's what gives you permission to not do anything. You beat yourself up and say, I'm done before
I
start.
What's the point?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. You're lying to yourself again. Well, what if this is the 101th time and it actually something changes, something actually clicks. You meet your mentor. Another thing too, did you really make your mind up? Are you really committed? Because to me, when you say, that's it, I'm in. What's your commitment level? 10. 10 out of 10. Universe says, okay, I'm going to send you a mentor. I'm going to send you something. Like, you're all of a sudden, doors open that's never opened before. Where did that come from? Or here's another, what does it mean, out of the blue? Oh, I got a call out of the
right.
Blue. Where's that? Where's out of the blue? I'm telling you, just the other day, a friend, unfortunately, lost his life, took his life about 6 months ago. I woke up last week and I had a thought. I wonder how my friend's wife is doing. It had to be so hard on her. And it's just a passing thought. I hadn't spoke to her in 6 months. She called me later that day. I was like, I'm sorry, what? She was, I was just wondering how you're doing. We haven't spoken since you know, we lost Fred. And I'm like, I just was thinking about you today. Out of the blue phone call? I don't know.
Well, this is a question. I have a couple questions that will come up with people reoccurring, and this is one of them that's come up two of the three last guests. So maybe it cements my answer to this question. But do you believe in coincidence?
Sometimes I call them God winks, serendipitous moments, synchronicities, like things like, where did that come from?
Yeah,
that stuff happens, and I think if you're paying attention, was it Helen Keller says life's either a daring adventure or nothing, and life's either a miracle or it's nothing. Like, there's little miracles going on all around us, but we're not really paying attention.
Right.
Like, yeah, just being even just going for a walk and being present. There's little miracles. Like, you ever notice like simple things like the bumblebees and the butterflies and just being present, like, wow, that tree grew like how many feet in the last, you know, like, we're not really paying attention.
No, we're definitely not. We're incentivized almost now not to.
Right. I think that's a big mistake. I think that we're technology is a wonderful tool, but when we are in it and inundated by it, and I've gotten caught up in it myself, but nature is that's where we came from. Like, our ancestors were in nature all the time. Technology's changed our brains. It's changed us as a people. And I think that we need to find more balance. That's another thing too, is when I work with clients, I like to create challenges with them. And when you create a challenge in nature, it changes your brain for the good. So I have a team of people I work with in New Hampshire, and about eight guys, and I said, guys, I want to do a challenge. It's called Masazi Challenge. It's a Japanese term for a ritual. It's like a challenge. It's a cleansing thing. It's something that's hard. Matter of fact, it might be so hard, you might not be able to finish it. What do you guys want to do? He says, well, how about climb Mount Washington? up in New Hampshire. I said, I'm in. Let's go. We're doing it now. I'm flying up in August, and we're climbing a mountain. We're doing a leadership retreat, actually. It's my first Beyond Vision mind, body, soul retreat. I'm flying up. We're going to do a golfing day, and then we're going to do dinner. We're going to have, I'm going to do a seminar and some leadership stuff. The next morning, we're getting up, and I'm going to lead them up a mountain. And this was part of my vision. So we talk about blind vision. I visualized this. I put it out there. I said I wanted this to happen. I didn't know how. I let go of the how. That's another thing, too. When you dream, let go of the how. It's not your job yet. Your job is just to dream. What do you want? What do you really want? And then you begin to visualize it, see it, write it down. And I really didn't know how. And all of a sudden, I got a group. I'm working with a group. I put it out there. They said, this is great. And then I'm like, oh, it manifested. But I took action, too. It doesn't just come out of the sky.
Yeah, exactly. And this is one thing I want to ask you, one more little deep one, and then we can touch on something maybe a little bit fun. But you said the mind-body-soul connection. How important do you find it to have something like going to climb the mountain after you have the talk? Because these mental shifts are so inextricably tied to some type of physical pushing or physical growth as well. So I guess the nutshell question is, how can you describe the importance of a growth mindset and a growth of yourself physically having to happen in lockstep?
Your brain has to change when you're doing something physical, different, demanding, challenging. There's a part of our brain that actually where the growth is. It's in the frontal lobe. It is, I'm not going to try to remember the area of the brain because I'll get it wrong. But there is an area in the brain. They've done research, especially with super achievers, live to 100, the people in the blue zones,
yeah,
the people that are doing things that are different.
Mm-hmm.
They've done brain scans, and their brains are lit up in the I think it's the right frontal lobe. I could be wrong on this, but there's a region of the brain that lights up. That is where growth is. And they're doing things that are different. That you can, there's the old saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. That is just not true.
Agreed.
Neuroplasticity is our mind's ability to change our brain. It comes, so when we do something physical, there's that mind body. Matter of fact, I had a shirt, I don't know where it went, but it said, get out of your mind and into your body. And so what happens is sometimes we need to get out of our mind. But when we're doing hard things in nature and we're present and we're like doing an activity, it's actually a form of meditation. And so part of the problem is that we are thinking too much, we're ruminating too much, we're thinking about the problems too much. And have you ever noticed like you go out for a jog or a walk or whatever and all of a sudden you get this idea? Where did it come from? You weren't thinking. My best ideas often come when I'm doing something challenging, and the reason being is because there's a lot of chemical soup going on in the brain. Like your testosterone level, your dopamine levels are going up. Everything's going up healthy. It's like a healthy cocktail in the brain, right? And so it makes us happier, healthier, can think more clearly, and you're calmer. So all those things help, and it retrains the brain. And so when you do things that are challenging and hard, and you're okay with failure, you're growing.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing, too, is I just done a ton of research on failure. Most people don't grow and adapt and change because they're afraid of the failure. You're going to fail. Get used to it. It's going to happen. You're going to look like an idiot sometimes. That's all right. Like, you think that, my dad mentioned, I wrote in the book, he's like, I went into a hardware store and I knocked everything off the frickin' shelves with my cane. He said, I felt like a fool. He said, but I made the sale. So are you willing to fail? Fail forward.
Be comfortable being uncomfortable, that sounds like.
Yeah, 100%. So, failure is like, and it's taught in school as failure is bad.
I think I feel like we need to ditch the word failure altogether because I feel in school it does get supplanted there. Mm-hmm. We got to replace failure with my first attempt, my second attempt.
I like that. An experience, an attempt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Because we lock each other down with that fear of failure. Little self-disclosure. I had a huge bone of that through a big part of my life, and letting go of that was humongously helpful for me as well. So that's just one that strikes a little close to home.
Well, and it's funny, like if I put minus 10 out of 20 versus plus 10 out of 20, what do you mean plus 10? Yeah, you got 10 right. Keep going. You're almost there.
Yeah.
Right? You got 10 right. Great job.
Yeah, we need to learn. We need to learn to couch things differently. That's my adage for that one, is either you were lucky to have your dog or you can be sad forever your dog died.
Yeah. Yep.
So
100%.
I kind of do that one. So let's get you out here on something maybe a little bit more fun. I know the backbone of this is kind of empowerment, and I can already tell we're going to have to do a part two with you. So
right,
don't feel bad that we didn't get it all in an hour. We're going to have another hour. But if you could drop someone one nugget to kind of empower themselves, get this gear turning, get out there and take this walk so this thing they can start to give themselves this freedom, what's one of the number one things you like to tell people to start to give themselves permission to grow?
Wow, great question. I think the start was like, ask yourself, what is the story I'm telling myself? What is the story I'm telling myself? What am I doing? Stop and pause. Slow down to speed up. I gotta reflect and think. Because if I don't, I'm going to keep repeating the same patterns. So I would say to pause and to think about, what do I really, really want?
Mm.
What do I really want? And then the next question is it obtainable? Like, I want to play in the NBA. No, sorry, that's not going to happen. It's too big of a gap.
Dang it, that was mine.
Yeah. You might need eyesight.
I know.
20/20 vision.
That's it. I'll go back to wrestling.
But So asking what you want, and then is it obtainable? And then what's my level of commitment?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you start. And I also think you need a support. You need friends. You need a coach or a mentor or somebody to be on your team. Because, again, really we're not meant to go about it alone. We need a community. Like everybody needs a tribe of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
So get around the right people and take baby steps if you have to. Some people – like need baby steps. Other people don't. Everybody's different too. So when I work with people, it's so simple. I'm like, I teach growth mindset and we do motivational interviewing. Like again, what do you really, really want?
Two reallys.
That's right.
It doesn't work with just one.
No, it doesn't.
Cause you can still lie to yourself with the one.
Yeah. Go deep. What do you want? Not what does your wife want? Not what does your boss want? What do you want? What do you want?
Really, really want.
Yeah, and then you have that desire, and then the desire is what's going to, the dopamine, the motivation to go after it day after day after day is going to keep getting higher and stronger, but that's where I would start.
Maybe we need to get some Sea Captain shirts that just say, what do you really, really want?
Yeah, I like that.
And that's it.
Yeah.
Well, Chad, I appreciate you coming down. I appreciate you sharing your valuable insight, and I already know I'm looking forward to round two. So,
well, I was great. I appreciate
it. Thank you,
man.
Sir. All right, appreciate
thanks.
It.
Appreciate it.